area, though, that where we see people starting to worry is automotive, as you said. And then that branches into two areas. One of them is the power handling, where, as you've said, the voltages are going higher. You know, we're thinking of silicon carbide components. That'll be 600, 1,000 volts. The currents are really high. The other area is in autonomous driving, where essentially you've got the electronics of a jet fighter at the mounted inside your car. You've got LiDAR and radar and high-speed communication. And what we're seeing there is that the risk of voids is now being taken really seriously, because it'll change the impedance of the circuit sufficiently that it's not consistent anymore. So whereas people were pretty casual about voids for, you know, the first 35, 40 years of surface mount, now here's an application where it really matters.
My guest today has worked in the automotive industry with both General Motors and Chrysler. In 1987, he joined the family business as CEO of Heller Industries. Heller Industries is a manufacturer of soldering and curing machines serving the electronic assembly and semiconductor packaging industries. Heller is truly an international company with locations in New Jersey, Korea, and China. And if you haven't guessed it, my guest is David Heller. David has a BS in mechanical engineering from Cornell University and an MBA from Harvard. He currently serves on the board of directors of a number of technology and medical startup and growth companies. And best of all, he's my guest today as we talk about all things reflow next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Welcome, Dave Heller. Thanks for being my guest today.
Mike, it's my pleasure. Thanks.
Well, thanks again. Thanks to you. Heller Industries was founded in 1960, which is the year I was born. Over the past 10 months, I've had experts on the show discussing board fabrication, thermal management, solder paste printing, X-ray, and virtually everything that surrounds reflow. We've talked about everything before the oven and everything after the oven. And then I realized that we've completely circled reflow technology, so I wanted to bring in an expert to discuss the reflow process. And I have to admit, the first name that came to mind was Heller. I realized that there are many manufacturers of reflow ovens today. But to me, Heller seemed like the generic name, like Coca-Cola or Xerox. I guess that's the benefit of being in business just a few weeks shy of 60 years.
Yeah, we're going to have a big party come June.
I can imagine. I can imagine. I understand Heller was founded in 1960. And can you tell me what led to the founding of Heller Industries? And given the fact that surface mount was at least 20 years into the future, what was Heller's primary product back then?
Well, the story was interesting. My father wrote a story about this nascent growth industry when he was in high school, and he was all interested in electronics. So when he graduated from engineering school in 1951, he went to work for General Electric in their training program and wound up at Lynn, Massachusetts, Evendale, Ohio, making jet engines, but then in Syracuse, New York, where they were doing electronic assembly. And half the group on Electronics Highway was military, the other half was commercial. And they were just at the beginning of the industry and figuring out everything for the first time. So while he was there, he came up with a drag solder machine, not knowing that there was such a thing as a wave solder, and experimented with solder fountains, and ultimately with a lead prep machine for manual insertion of components, since there were no auto insertion machines at that time.
It's funny you say drag solder machine. My first entry into this industry, which was in 1985, your company was already 25 years old by then, was in drag soldering machines. We built and sold drag soldering machines at the very tail end of through-hole. Surface mount was being talked about, and you know, we tried to figure out ways we could dunk a surface mount component into a pool of solder, and obviously that wasn't very successful. But certainly drag soldering machines were great for through-hole technology, particularly long-leaded through-hole technology, where you tended to solder the boards and cut the leads later.
Right, right. Or solder cut solder.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What were some of the big, Zivatech, I think, was one of the bigger names in drag soldering machines back in the day.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, after GE Syracuse, my father went to work for a company in New Jersey called Blonder Tongue, and they were taking this new printed circuit board technology for commercial work. And that's where he developed the series of lead prep machines, and then decided to go out on his own and make lead prep equipment. And that was our core business through the mid-1980s. And then with the advent of surface mount, I had joined the company from the auto industry, and we decided we had to do something in surface mount. Taking place looked kind of complicated and scary, and printers, too mechanical, but ovens, that looked interesting because they got hot. So that's how we evolved into the oven business.
Interesting. Well, we'll get more into that in a few minutes. I've interviewed a few CEOs that kind of took over their family business from their fathers, and each of them have shared stories on this show of their younger days at the family business,
right,
performing some of the least desired functions, like sweeping the floor, drilling through holes, you know, in bare boards. Were you subject to that rite of passage as well?
Yes, absolutely. I had to go through a hazing process. I started as a vice president of agriculture by cutting the lawns on Saturday. But the good advantage is I learned how to drive a riding mower. So when it was time to get my driver's license, I already kind of knew what I was doing. Then went to work in the machine shop, between on holidays or when I wasn't in at school. One summer worked in the machine shop, so had some background in machining as well.
When I was a kid, you know, one of my chores was to mow the lawn. And, you know, I grew up in California. We don't have large swaths of land, you know, that houses are built on like other parts of the country. And I think the house was about 1,200 square feet. It was probably on a quarter acre lot. And I remember desperately trying to talk my dad into buying a John Deere riding mower. I don't even think I can make a U-turn with it, but you know, and stay on the lawn. But I think I would have been much more eager to cut the lawn if I could ride a machine rather than push something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what other things did you do there what age were you when you started working at Heller Industries?
Well, I worked after engineering, I worked for General Motors for a while, and then worked with my father for a little bit, then went back to grad school and worked at Chrysler. And then after Chrysler, I came back full time. So that was in 87. I was 28.
So you worked before college and in Ministry of Agriculture, and then you worked after college. Your college is very impressive. You have an MS in mechanical engineering from Cornell, not too shabby, and an MBA from Harvard, not too shabby.
Yeah.
I imagine that may have come in handy. Did your father have the same credentials, or was he?
Yeah, he was a mechanical engineer and essentially finished his MBA at night. When he was in that GE training program between Syracuse University and University of Maryland. So,
well, very good. That may explain why your company's been around for 60 years. So let's talk about reflow ovens. Reflow ovens have been around since I think around the 80s. I remember. And can you tell me how they've changed over the years in order to overcome technical challenges throughout the years? And let's begin with the earliest ovens that you can recall. Can you describe them?
Right. You know, in the early days, there were really two alternates. One was to use IR, and that would have been either a medium wave, the old Vitronics panel machines, or short wave, which was the older RTC furnaces. And really, the RTC machine was a high temperature furnace that was descaled for surface mount. And there were challenges with each. The RTCs had the challenge that you couldn't measure temperature directly. You had to measure it indirectly. And keeping the process under control was difficult because the lamps were happy full on or full off, but modulating them was tough. Just really hairy control algorithm problem. IR panels were more gentle and easier to control. The challenge there was with heavy load. When you would have very heavy load, particularly in the middle of the panel where the thermocouple was located, the edges would tend to overheat and you would have uniformity problems under load. But also when the industry started using PLCCs, it was real hard to get the component uniformly heated. So you'd have a large thermal mass with your PLCC, and your R's and C's would overheat, and you could generate 10, 15 degree deltas if you weren't careful. You could always slow down the process, but then you'd lose control of your time above liquidus. So there were two companies, SPT and Heller, who first started building these forced convection machines, SPT first. That was clearly a better way to go to have the best uniformity, the most gentle heating, the best delta T. And it was pretty clear that that was an advantage. And ultimately, the other companies started producing these forced convection machines as well. In parallel, we always had the vapor phase machines, but the challenge there was operating economy, because the floor inert was expensive. And yeah. The other challenge, of course, was that they're essentially batch machines. So throughput was a challenge. But if you've got a super heavy thermal mass and horrendous disuniformity of thermal mass, it always worked, and it still is a reasonable solution. But that's the a fringe solution, maybe a 1 or 2% of the market.
Yeah, I've seen it. I don't want to say comeback. That's way over exaggerated. But I travel a lot, and I see a lot of factories. And in the last year or two, I've seen a couple, probably no more than two, newer installations of vapor phase. And I guess it's just for the fringe technologies that. Where the conventional technologies just are good, but not good enough for a really challenging application.
You know, the place where it really makes sense is in very low volume and typically military assemblies.
That's exactly where I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if each circuit board is very, very expensive and you're only given a kit with enough that you have to produce them all, you can't afford to have a profile board. Everyone has to work. It has to be perfect. You can't profile. And that's a reasonable application for vapor phase. Mm-hmm. Then there's another advantage, too, that most of these vapor phase machines now come with vapor recovery. They've basically got a vacuum chamber at the end where they evaporate off all the solvent. And that acts as a devoiding station. And it helps with void minimization.
I would imagine it's given the size of Heller, that's probably too small a market for Heller to pursue. Is that correct?
You know, the ultimate question is, do our customers need it? And every now and then we'll have a survey and talk to people, and our typical customers are not looking for that product.
Right.
There are a couple brands made in Europe, and they're good machines, but our guys are rarely looking for that kind of solution.
Right. We battle that in our business, building cleaning systems, where someone will want something rather custom. And a salesman never likes to say no, right? So they come marching into my office going, I got this great idea. And then when we kind of, we play it out and kind of pro forma it. And we realize that if we could say yes instead of no, we'd sell maybe two extra machines a year. Or, it's like asking Ford to build a Taurus 6 inches longer. The cost of doing that is outrageous, and the return on that is virtually non-existent. So it's probably good to let the fringe players do what they do well and concentrate on the kind of the 80-20 rule, right?
Yes. The hardest thing is to say no. We rarely do that.
Yeah. Well, I've said this on other episodes, I think, but we've learned over 27 years in business that sometimes the word no is way more profitable than the word yes.
Oh yeah. And absolutely.
But that's hard. That's hard to convey, to get the troops to kind of buy into that philosophy.
Right. Right.
So like many other high-tech products, while the product may be able to physically function, their usefulness may become obsolete over time. And I can think of like a computer or a mobile phone. If someone gave me a first generation MacBook, it would be completely useless today with today's applications and today's speed requirements. And the same could be said if someone gave me the first generation BlackBerry. So in that context, if, for example, a contract manufacturer was in the market say a brand new contract manufacturer. They don't have any equipment. And the first thing they do is go out to the used market and look for something cheap and, you know, useful, operative word being useful. What, in your opinion, would be the minimum features and capabilities that you'd recommend on any brand of oven? You know, what should people Right. look for today to be useful today?
I think there's a number of issues that are generally settled in the industry. The first one would be, how many zones do you really need to get a decent no-lead profile and have some flexibility? And in general, 5 would be the smallest, but often people will, you know, think around 7. I would say that 10 is the typical number. And the issue of mesh belt and edge hold, I would say most people are, you know, going with mesh with edge hold. But if you can buy a machine with both, it just makes it a little more flexible. The real question is nitrogen. And nitrogen is a little bit like fashion. If you go to certain parts of Asia, everybody just runs nitrogen. It's what you do. But in America, far less. Because in America, we tend to water wash, we clean after. So we do use maybe a little bit different philosophy, maybe more aggressive flux. But the fraction of people using nitrogen in the U.S. is more modest. And as a result, I would say somebody starting out, that would be one area that you wouldn't have to go for the most expensive solution. A simple air machine would probably be fine.
Right. I remember when lead-free first emerged on the scene, and there was a huge talk of nitrogen. And going to shows, I'd see, you know, nitrogen generation machines, you know, so you didn't have to rent the tanks and all that. That was the big talk back then, but it looks like it kind of settled out a little bit. And I think your point of cleaning is well taken in Asia, where, you know, the major production lies. There's not a lot of cleaning going on in Asia because they have this huge economy of scale, and they can, you know, I can't imagine Foxconn is taking every iPhone board and running it through a, you know, an inline cleaner or a batch cleaner. They have the ability, unlike us mere mortals, you know, they can build, you know, 10 million of something every month, and they can not only design for manufacturability, they can design for non-cleanability or whatever it is they want to eke out of the process to capture some more profit. Yeah, that makes perfect sense that, you know, nitrogen would be more common there and less common here, where we're building smaller batch sizes and typically, or at least more typically today, cleaning than was in the past. There's a term that I like to use, and I call it an evolution cycle. And that's a cycle when products evolve to the point where they provide a substantial new set of capabilities or features. So hypothetically, and if an equipment manufacturer debuts a new oven every 2 years, there may not be a substantially new capability set or feature set every 2 years, you know, model on model. Perhaps it might take 3 to 5 model changes to evolutionize the capabilities. An example that comes to mind is going back to, again, the iPhone. You know, the first iPhone was revolutionary. The second model was probably quite evolutionary. Maybe even the third model was evolutionary. But today's iPhones, every 2 years when they come out with one, really are not evolutionary anymore. They might have a few added pixels on the camera. They might have a slightly faster processor or make the packages in new colors. But not every new model is evolutionary. So that brings up two questions. One, what is the evolution cycle on reflow ovens with substantial new features and capabilities? And is that evolution cycle speeding up or slowing down?
I think that we could see early in the market, early in the life of our industry, let's say in the 80s and 90s, the evolution was rapid. We were all learning what worked and what didn't work. And now that evolution is on a more moderate pace. But I think we're still evolving. We are, you know, I would say in our company, every, let's say 5 years, we'll come up with a new model where that is no longer backward compatible. with what right. we have been building. So we'll give it a new moniker, but we'll have a very significant number of design changes. It's variations on a theme, but in all ways, incrementally better. We do a lot of special machines, and that creates learning. And then we gather up all of that learning, revisit what we our standard product, and say, you know, we can make this better, either more reliable or takes a lot of cost out, add, bring value to the customer. So what we'll do is every 5 years, we'll have a new platform and continue to evolve continuously through the life of that platform. And what's unbelievable to me is we've been making these machines for a long time now, you know, 25, 30 years, and we're still taking about 5% of the cost out per year. And when we do that, we're typically improving the performance, whether it's cross-belt uniformity, lower temperature deltas under the center board support, straighter center board support, lower nitrogen consumption, ease of building. You would think that it would peter out, but somehow or another, we keep on going. And we have I have one more generation in my head. So there's a good 5 years worth of innovation left for that product line at a minimum.
Oh, very good.
And you know, the thing that we're looking at and just kind of wondering when it's going to happen, when will the issues of global warming and power consumption start filtering down to circuit board assembly? And when are they going to come to us and say, all right, we need your oven to reduce power consumption by 75%. Water washing and ovens, that's where the energy is. And, you know, when are we both going to get tagged and have to seriously evolve the design again for low power consumption?
Yeah, there's in our business, it's because we build batch machines, it's not a big power issue, but we've seen that environmental consciousness awakening with regard to what goes down the drain. Our first machines sent everything down the drain. You know, we weren't putting CFCs up the stack, so we thought we were the green guys, right? So we were just putting dirty water down the drain. And then and then all of a sudden people said, okay, fine, you know, the ozone's safe now. What's going down the drain? And we had to evolve and create new technology that didn't put anything down the drain. And then, you know, being in California where we either have we have a constant state of no water and wind and fire. And, you know, right now, today, my state is on fire.
Yes.
So there's a big concern over water consumption. And, you know, the amounts that we used of water that we bragged about 20 years ago, and we only used 12 gallons a load, or, you know, which seemed amazingly low. Now people are critiquing that. And for two reasons. One is they're either environmentally conscious and want to do the right thing to make a better world for their grandkids, et cetera. And there's another group that, you know, finds it to be financially advantageous to conserve because it saves money. It prohibits fines and you know, inspectors walking up their pipes and things like
yes.
that. So I always say that people chase two greens, either the environmental green or the currency green. Either way, the result drives more efficient processes and
yes.
more environmentally responsible processes, regardless of the motivation that the customer has.
Yes, I agree.
So some of the past reflow challenges included, as I recall, and I'm no expert on reflow, but from what I could see from the cheap seats, was the switch to lead-free. That was big because it requires higher reflow temperatures and at least in the beginning, the use of inert atmospheres. What are some of the challenges today in reflow that we're seeing more now? You know, what's the next lead-free to shake up
right.
the reflow business?
I think the perennial concern is service and service interval. And trying to minimize the amount of downtime that can be expected with the machine. So flux management is always a big issue. And ease of cleaning, reliability is a given. You just assume that the machine, once installed, will work reliably for years. And, you know, I think that certain aspects of performance then become the next issue. Can you provide low nitrogen consumption and low power consumption in a given machine size? Occasionally, people will compete on delta T on a test board, but in general, most machines are good enough these days. So the one that really comes out, particularly in the high throughput Asian customers, is service interval and then ease of service.
Mm-hmm. Right. They would kind of want to plug and play and forget about it.
Yep.
For as long
yep.
as possible. So we went through a phase in this industry, I'm sure you recall it even more than I do, where, and I'm just kind of speaking in generalities here, where one Chinese manufacturer would build either a reflow oven or a wave soldering machine or a conveyor, and it was sold by a dozen different companies, private label,
right.
but under their own name, each company undercutting the price of their competitor who sold the exact same machine. And in that scenario, there was little, if any, differentiation from product to product. Is there an advantage? This is kind of a softball question, because obviously there is an advantage. But what I want to hear is, you know, what are the advantages of selecting any type of equipment, not just reflow, from the manufacturer directly, as opposed to,
right.
you know, some private label deal where the market is flooded with cheap products that
right.
And they may not have a direct link to the actual manufacturer.
I would say, fortunately for us, that business model was absolutely not sustainable. And it is not necessarily because of the hardware. It's because of the different organization behind the hardware.
Right.
And should there be a problem, and you're talking to a distributor who really has no ability to service the product, you're in bad shape. And if you as a process engineer have specced in a machine that can't be serviced adequately and the factory is down because of your decision, it's a career ender. And very quickly, people got the word that while you could buy a very inexpensive machine from a general distributor, if there were problems, and because these machines were new to North America, there were, then you were in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So the way the market evolved is that all of the domestics started building their machines in China. And so the cost of manufacture was not that different between the local brands and the U.S. companies operating there. And the price advantage was modest. And the support difference was enormous. So it wasn't just machine support, it was process support. It was the ability to speak the same language, to be in the same time zone, to have rapid access to repair and parts. So again, the non-machine issues dominated and really helped us maintain our market share.
Sure. I think it probably sounds Pollyannish, but I do believe that the best experience is buy direct from the manufacturer. I mean, obviously you go through distribution, that doesn't change it. You still have access to the manufacturer, and because the manufacturer is really a partner with
yes.
with their customer, even though that sounds like a cliche, sounds like some Fifth Avenue, you know, marketing thing, but it's true. And
yes.
you know, I've seen you know, probably about 15 years ago, I saw the start of the commoditization of assembly equipment. And these are not commodities. These are
right.
highly engineered devices, complex devices that, you know, the better engineered they are, the easier they are to operate. But there's still a lot of technology behind any type of assembly equipment, whether it's pick and place, reflow, printing, you know, even conveyors. And when I saw conveyors flood the market, I'm like, okay, well, I can see that. I don't have a great appreciation for the complexity of a conveyor. But when I started to see it happen with reflow ovens and printers and other type cleaners even, and other types of products, it really made me worry, because it kind of pollutes the entire market and sets this expectation of such a low price, which, as you said, is not sustainable for any length
right.
of time. I think
yeah.
it's dangerous for the community, actually.
Yeah, I agree. there were a few people when I started in the industry who I really admired. John Pomeroy, who ran Dover's Electronics Group, was one. And we talked about this trend and this issue. And I was young, but he had been around a long time. And he explained, look, it's going to be painful, but it's not sustainable. And so we'll get through this. We'll live. And the industry will figure it out really quickly. Because if you buy a cut rate piece of equipment and it goes down and you can't support it, you got a world of hurt. So the industry figured it out very quickly.
Yeah, it usually does. It's just a painful lesson that you know, you sit on the sidelines and you can predict it, but no one's going to believe you until they actually experience it.
Yep.
My father used to be a computer programmer, you know, way back in the day before there were personal computers. And, you know, his company all bought IBM. That was pretty much the only player on the market, you know, IBM. And their tagline back in the 60s and 70s was, you know, you might pay a lot of money, but you'll never get fired for buying one of our machines, you know,
because it's true.
You had this behemoth company behind it and supporting it. And I think the same lessons apply today. You know, if you can, it's not all about price. It's about value. It's about support. It's about shipping your products reliably, not cutting out every penny. People don't realize how costly it is to have products in the field that are not reliable. It's way more expensive to fix something than it is to build it right.
Yes. You know, and a lot of what we do also winds up being semi-custom. So people will have an unusual requirement, and we're more than happy to do that. You can't do that out of a catalog with a distributor. That has to go direct to the factory.
Right.
And it has become a larger part of our business as well.
Right. And sometimes you have to tell a customer, you know, with today's technology, that can't be done, you know, and rather than someone that just going back to our former discussion, you can't just say yes all the time and then try and figure it out after you get the purchase order.
Right. Although that does happen too.
Well, we've done that. I mean, I'm a little bit hypocritical when I say that, because we've, you know, in our early days, we're like, yeah, sure. In fact, we say yes before the question is even finalized. Hey, can you? Yeah. Sure.
Sure,
we can do that. Yeah, the costly lessons. Let's talk about thermal management for a minute. I had MB Allen from Kik on the show a few months ago, and you know, they're real tight with oven manufacturers and extracting data and perhaps even giving data back to the oven. And I watched a couple of your company's videos this morning and yesterday. And either you or one of your colleagues was talking about the ability for the oven to postpone starting until everything is back up to temperature. So, you know, obviously, you know, in today's modern technology, we have the ability to close loop everything in terms of information flow. What's the reason, I asked Kik the same question, but what's the reason there are thermal management companies and oven companies? Why aren't there oven companies with all that thermal management capability? Is it just, you know, such a specialty that it's best having, you know, experts in their field perform those functions? Or I've often wondered why there isn't a thermal management device that just is part of the oven. You know, how come Heller doesn't buy Kik or whoever, you know, name the name.
Sure. You know, I think the issue is that there's a little, credibility is a good way to put it. You know, why doesn't the oven check its own work? Process control says I'd rather have a third party, a box that you guys didn't make, confirm your oven's performance.
Otherwise, the oven would be going, looks good to me.
Yep. We're always good.
Always
green.
Good. Looks perfect. Right. Yeah, it's always in green. Yeah.
And, you know, to a degree, we all grew up in parallel. Kik was making their systems, ECD, as we were learning how to do ovens. And they became established in parallel to us. And it didn't seem necessary or appropriate for us to offer a product that was essentially as good or as a Kik or an ECD or a solder star or any of the other products made throughout the world. It has evolved into a reasonably stable business.
Yeah.
They do what they do. And we're always happy to work closely with them. You know, we'll install their equipment on our machines at our factory or retrofit in the field as the customer asks.
Oh, that makes sense. It's a specialty and it's a core competency issue.
Yeah. And actually the software for prediction is not trivial.
No, you can't just start a profiling company and come up with those algorithms and those predictors. That has to be based, I would imagine, on lots of historical data.
Yeah. Yep.
It would be like, showing up in Vegas, predicting when red 23 is going to land on the wheel at roulette. You know, it's right. You need to see the board and see what the history is and make an informed decision. It would be hard to just show up there without any knowledge of history and odds and things like that and get that right. And that's probably way infinitely easier than thermal management and predictive technologies.
Yes. Yes.
Talk about 4.0, Industry 4.0. That is a huge buzzword today. And I kind of blame you guys, not Heller, but I think it's that came out of the oven, the need for ovens to talk to everything before it and after it. You know,
right.
I don't know if blame is the right word. Maybe credit would be a more positive way to say it. I can totally see the value of your type of equipment capturing data because you're the kind of the heart of the entire assembly industry. Everything pre-reflow is to get everything ready for reflow, and everything after reflow is to clean up everything after reflow. And the reflow is just the center of the universe for assembly. So 4.0 seems to have kind of come out of that need. How has that landed on your industry and with competing standards and protocols and all of that? Are you guys involved in the IPC standards?
Sure.
And all that?
Yeah. Mark Payo, our president, is deeply involved with the standards. And, the two analogies would be either the Tower of Babel or the United Nations General Assembly.
Identify with the UN. I've been in some of those standards meetings, and it's you know, the saying is every country heard from, you know?
Yep. So typically what happens is customers love to have MIS systems. They would love to have all sorts of information, and they particularly are happy when it's free. So the industry, I think, has come to expect that the pick-and-place company will supply software, and everybody knows that software doesn't cost anything, so of course you should give it to me for free.
Of course, software's free. It's the cost of a thumb drive, right? It's
exactly.
16 cents.
Yeah, really.
No R&D
so,
at all.
To a degree, we follow the lead of the pick-and-place companies, and we have to have software that allows our machine to be compatible with a line set up with the various brands. They tend to be similar but different. Then there's the new standards, Hermes or an IPC standard. So,
that's CFX. Is that what the IPC
yes,
one? CFX?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. We have essentially one or two ways to communicate, and then we assign a front end or a back end to that bit of hardware software package so that we can talk to the various pick and place machines. The other family of communication is SexGem, but that's almost all semiconductor.
Okay.
And very little of that's done in surface mount.
So the two standards today are Hermes and CFX, right? As I understand it. Are they compatible standards? Are they competing standards? Is it, you know, VHS and Betamax, or are they closer than that?
But I would also argue there's a third competition with entity, which would be the in-house communication system sold by or marketed by the pick and place companies.
Mm.
So we'll have something that's compatible with the majors.
So you have to build to at least three standards right now and be compatible with
easily.
Whatever they plug in.
Yep.
Will we come down to one? Do you think, or do you think they'll just will the market just whittle it down to one, or do you think there's enough need to have at least three different standards simultaneously?
I what is utterly, is so interesting to me that we here in North America, we're thinking that, all right, the industry is coming to a consensus. And then all of a sudden, the Japanese assembly industry came out with its own version of communication protocol, unbeknownst to the guys over here. So it isn't consolidating. It's
expanding still.
Absolutely. We have proliferation. And that, I think, is the nature of our business. People are always seeking that next 2 or 3% of advantage. And they will, there will always be new, better, I like mine better, so I'm going to use it, subgroups. So, you know, the other thing that we saw was that some of the large EMS companies were trying to develop their own in-house capability. And, you know, even if they had 3 or 4 different pick and place platforms, they wanted one version for their entire company. And that has turned into an enormous challenge because you've got competing centers of influence in these multinational companies, and the Mexicans want this and the Europeans want that. And, but in China, they do come something completely different. Mm. And, you know, it is still spreading.
Well, if this was easy, everyone would be making reflow ovens, right?
So yes.
Maybe that's good.
But now, but everyone in reflow now has a significantly larger software team than they had 5 years ago.
Sure, right. I mean, it used to be a mechanical company, right? You
yes.
bolted
yes.
things together and yeah. had a PLC that or a PC or whatever that ran the show. Now you're almost like an IT company.
Very much so. Yeah, that has changed.
So what are the most, this is one of my favorite questions, just, you know, from curiosity. What are some of the most common mistakes made when either selecting or using a reflow oven from your perspective?
I think that the one area where people can get into trouble is when they look at their reflow oven as one size fits all and try to run pretty much everything through one profile. Because they're, it's almost true, but it isn't completely true. And it's not true enough of the time so that you can't do that. You really ought to profile similar boards of similar thermal mass, because every now and then there'll be something that you didn't think of and it's a gotcha. And then you've got a cold joint or some other issue. I think the critical thing is to do one's homework and profile new assemblies and invest the time just to make sure everything is quite good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. In my business, the post-reflow cleaning industry, I have some pet peeves, and it doesn't take much to get me on a soapbox and complain. But one of them is when a so-called manufacturer sells a relabeled dishwasher or a glassware washer, calling it a circuit board cleaner. And you know, they rarely work well, and they leave a less than confident impression on the entire cleaning industry, casting a shadow on everybody in this industry, the good guys, the bad guys, everyone in the middle. Are there any pet peeves when it comes to the reflow industry? This is your chance to get on a soapbox and kind of bitch and moan a little bit about your industry and specifically. Is there anything that just drives you crazy?
I think that at the very low end, there are some machines that technically work, but only in a very, very small subset of all possibilities. Very low throughput, very simple boards, and for a relatively short period of time, you know, most production equipment is made to a far more robust standard. But every now and then I'll see a limited production system that is very inexpensive and think, oh, I don't know. But that's the one that gets me.
Well, you have your version of dishwashers in your industry. I've seen what look like toaster ovens
yes.
with modified controllers on them being sold as reflow machines. And
yep.
You know, nothing moves. It's totally batch. And I would imagine maybe they ramp up and ramp down and whatever. But they do look remarkably like, you know, something you would see, you know, the word Maytag on or Sunbeam or some retail thing.
Oh, Yeah, in the cleaner business for sure. There's sometimes I'll open it up and go, this is a dishwasher, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, right. Yeah. We see those every day. Yeah, and you know, ironically, sometimes they work. You know, because the application is very easy, and so you know, people think it works, and well, they're going to buy it because they wouldn't be selling it if it didn't work. But that's not always true in our industry.
Yes,
as we all know. Looking forward, you know, this podcast is all about reliability. Do you have any specific concerns over reliability in general in the entire assembly process? I know the auto industry is concerned about reliability because they're talking about ramping up the voltage on cars to 1,000 volts, even 1,200 volts. And there's this debate about, you know, high voltage, low current, or the other way around. And the margin for error is very, very low when you're running that much voltage through a board for a lot of different reasons. Do you see our industry moving forward in a way that concerns you with regard to reliability?
You know, I would say that in general, the solder paste and the complementary technology has evolved so that the assembly process is extremely robust. The area, though, that where we see people starting to worry is automotive, as you said. And then that branches into two areas. One of them is the power handling, where, as you've said, the voltages are going higher. You know, we're thinking of silicon carbide components. That'll be 600, 1,000 volts. The currents are really high. The other area is in autonomous driving, where essentially you've got the electronics of a jet fighter at the mounted inside your car.
Right.
You've got LiDAR and radar and high-speed communication. And what we're seeing there is that the risk of voids is now being taken really seriously because it'll change the impedance of the circuit sufficiently that it's not consistent anymore. So whereas people were pretty casual about voids for, you know, the first 35, 40 years of surface mount, now here's an application where it really matters. You know, you can argue that voids are not super critical for BGAs. Occasionally you'll get into trouble. Dave Hillman did some real good work at Rockwell Collins. Some other folks at Lucent have done excellent work there. You know, but here's a case where there's no doubt people want to make sure there are no voids in that segment of the automotive circuit assembly area.
Sure, and you brought up a concern in the early days of reflow that there was a wide variation of component sizes and masses on a board.
Yes,
I'm thinking that, you know, Tesla and whoever, I just use Tesla as a generic, you know, electric car example. I've seen some of their boards, and there is a mixture of large power devices and QFNs on the same board with very large traces because they're running all this current through it. That has got to present some new challenges, even more so than maybe the early days, in terms of the variation in mass on an assembly, and you know, areas of the board that could be overheated or underheated depending upon what they're trying to protect. Is that something that's come back again, or is that just an evolution of normal electronics today?
I think that Tesla is an excellent example of some very challenging hardware. They also, I think, will benefit from a vacuum process to devoid their critical solder joints. The autonomous control systems that you were describing, made by Tesla and Super Cruise, others, it's a enormous potential liability issue for the automakers, you know, should something go wrong. And, you know, how much are you willing to spend to make sure that the board is built with the utmost reliability? And the answer is quite a bit. They'll do whatever it takes to make sure that these are reliable. So it justifies a lot of special handling, and like vacuum reflow, like extensive cleaning. just to make sure there's you take out every opportunity for a failure.
Yeah, I've said this on this show before, but the technology in a car has morphed from entertainment to safety as more drivers are relying on adaptive cruise control or lane departure warnings or blind spot indicators, not to even mention autonomous driving. We are becoming worse drivers because we're relying on this technology. You know, we don't look over our shoulder. The first car I got with blind spot indicators, I would look over my shoulder and look at the blind spot indicator so I had a gut feeling that they're both in sync. There's truly nothing there.
Yes.
The first time I bought a car recently, last year, that has adaptive cruise control that uses LiDAR or some technology like that. You know, whenever I got close to somebody, my foot was over the brake just in case the computer didn't catch it. And it hasn't failed me yet. But the, you know, BMW just last year, 2018, recalled a whole bunch of cars on their electric model, their i3, i8, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a cleaning issue and their method of protecting the driver when their systems found some board wasn't working properly was to immediately shut down the car, which was their way of protecting the driver. Well, if I was on the fast lane passing somebody or whatever, and all of a sudden my car turned off, that's not cool. You know, that could put me in more danger. And that reminds me, and I've said this on the show before, so my apologies to the audience who've heard this before. You know, they came up with a software fix for a hardware problem. And not too long ago, Boeing tried that with disastrous results. So, you know, we just need to build it right the first time. And unlike the aviation industry, we don't have the benefit of three main computers as for redundancy. We have to have one, and it has to always work. So every connection needs to be solid. Every software program needs to be thoroughly vetted. And it's no longer a case where we don't get to listen to XM radio if something fails. Now it may mistake something that's not in front of us for something that is in front of us, and slam on the brakes when it shouldn't, or not slam on the brakes when it should. I mean, our lives are at stake with this reliability expectation. And then this whole IoT thing is a little bit crazy. You know, we're putting electronics in things merely because we can, not because we really need to. And, you know, when IoT explodes, as it's doing now, and it will continue to do so over the next coming years, we tend to take electronics out with us, and the whole nature of IoT, everything is a connected device, and we go into harsh environments and we drag our electronics into harsh environments. And it really is testing the bounds of reliability in the electronic industry. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. There's a lot of talk right now about trade tariffs and our trade war against China, and the reciprocal trade war that China has. You know, our equipment going into China, we don't build in China, but our equipment going into China is suddenly 25% more expensive, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, we don't really have a horse in that race. You build not just in China, but I think you build in Korea as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
So did you shift production to Korea?
Yes.
Oh, smart move. So your equipment is not subject to any of the tariffs coming into
this
country.
Right.
Because it's built in Korea.
Yeah. You know, when the rules came out, it was as if somebody had it in for our business, because one of the SIC codes was very, very specific about, you know, solder reflow ovens used to assemble printed circuit boards. It could not have been any more specific.
Right. Everything else is very generic and yours is very specific.
Yes.
Well, that probably helps protect some of the companies there that are building reflow ovens, but it does also affect even people who aren't buying ovens from China. You know, it affects companies like us that are selling to China because all of a sudden we're in the war, and
you know,
we didn't start it, and we don't really have a horse in that race. But it's a regrettable thing, and that this is not a political show, so I won't make it one. But I think some people in the higher levels of the government forget who pays tariffs. And, you know, we pay the tariffs. We taxpayers in the United States pay the tariffs if we buy something that's made in a country where we impose tariffs. It's not a tax on the manufacturer. It's a tax on the buyer. And
absolutely.
It's it may be raising all this money from, you know, for the government, but we might as well just write checks to the government because it's the same effect. So I think one way or the other, and I've said this before, one way or the other, this is going to be resolved in a relatively quick manner. It just can't go the direction it's going. We are a global economy, and I have no problem with things being built all over the world. We are well past a monolithic society. We are global in nature. So every, in our equipment, there are things made from all over that go into our equipment, even though we make it here. There's certain things we just can't source here because it's just not made.
And
I'm a big believer in buy local, and then if you can't, extend the reach. Certainly that's something that is landing on the electronics industry between components and equipment and things like that. It's a little scary and a little disappointing, but hopefully that'll be resolved soon.
Yeah, I agree deeply with the philosophy of free trade, but I also understand that there are certain practices that were, shall we say, not fair.
Clearly.
Needed to be evolved. I might have created a different tact for applying pressure because the way that we did it from a single point may not have been the most effective. But I hope that you're right that it gets resolved soon.
I hope so. I think it will, but I have no basis for that. I just have a gut that it will be, insanity. Once everything, once every side keeps raising the stakes, at some point that will break. And, everyone needs to just go back and do their business.
And
sooner that all that can be cleared out of the way, the better. And then we can concentrate on the reasons behind them separately and more effectively and more focused than just throwing these large number tariffs out on everybody. That just, it just causes the Chinese people to pay more money and the American people to pay more money. It doesn't really resolve the problem, at least from this vantage point. But at any rate, well, that's good for you that you're able to shift production to another one of your facilities. So you have three facilities, right? Am I right in saying New Jersey? Is that one of them?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, New Jersey was our original facility, and we retain all of our engineering for the semiconductor products, and then China and Korea. The each group has its own roughly equally sized engineering department.
Wow. What an enterprise. So thank you, David, for being my guest on the show. It's been very interesting. I love the topic of reflow. As I said earlier, I think that's kind of the heart of the electronic assembly industry. Pick and place guys might have a feud with that statement, but that's okay.
Sure.
They're big. They can handle that. But thank you for agreeing to be on the show. You're a wealth of knowledge, and I like all the insight that you've given on the whole topic of reflow.
Mike, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
My pleasure. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcast. Reliability Matters and other reliability-based podcasts are available at Circuit Assembly's PCB Chat at pcbchat.com and at Ascendo Reliability at reliability.fm. Thanks for your comments. Please keep them coming. Send comments and episode suggestions to Mike at mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.